You're listening to the Strategic Marketing Podcast with Omar Merlo and Andreas Eisengrich, with this week's special guests, Maya Voyer and Jaka Levstik.
Here we go. It's pressed. It's
test going. 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3. And I won't touch it. That's it.
I would just like to talk for a minute. That would be amazing. It would be so nice to talk for a minute. Can't wait to talk for a minute. Isn't enough? I'm feeling awkward.
Right, welcome everybody to this episode 4 of our podcast. And today we're going to talk about something very interesting, something timely, something important, which is branding in the context of startups. And I'm Omar Merlo, director, academic director of the Strategic Marketing Program at Imperial College Business School. And I'm joined by my colleague, Andreas.
It's great to have you. Thank you so much for joining and super excited about today's session. And we welcome Jaka and Maya. So Jaka.
Yeah. Hi. Hello. Hi, Omar and Andreas. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here. So my name is Jaka Levstik. I'm a CEO and a co-founder of a company incubator called D-Labs. We've been involved with startups for the last, it's 11 years right now. I've built over 70 of them. Had a few kind of big hitters in between. So I'm really looking forward to sharing the experiences we've had over the years.
Great. Fantastic. And Maya, welcome.
Thank you so much for hosting me as well. So I'm a big sinner in terms of branding, right? As a growth consultant, I have been working with more than 250 companies so far, luckily including D-Labs, because those guys literally changed the way how I see branding. And it's very interesting in startups because at the beginning, you always want to cut costs on this, right? And you don't perceive to be extremely important. But if you do that, you will have to pay dearly for it in a year or so. So I'm very excited to bring in some experience from the field.
Thank you very much. I guess we can get right into it because, you know, one of the things that we often talk about in when we talk about branding is, you know, the typical examples are the big ones, right? The Googles of this world, the Apples of this world. We all talk about established brands, you know, but what about early stage companies, small companies? When should a founder start thinking about a brand? Is that something that should begin right away or should come later?
Well, I think it's changed throughout the years quite enormously, to be honest. I think at the, you know, probably if you look at it like mid 2000s, most of these sort of types of companies that we would today refer to as startups was basically all about kind of moving software into the cloud. And it was this kind of functionality and pricing aspect and the aspect of connecting people in this sort of collaborative mode, aka the functionality that played the crucial part. But I think as these, as the whole sector is maturing and also as it's moving down from kind of targeting big enterprise and moving more and more into consumer space, obviously brands are becoming a lot more important. And as much as we've seen startups kind of, or a very few startups starting to think about brands very early, maybe even at the break of the decade, we're now seeing this becoming more and more of a crucial part in developing startups. So, you know, we all know the story, for example, of the company called Moo, which was this business card making, you know, startup that put an immense focus on how they're dealing with the brand and the brand experience. And that was the backbone of their massive growth because they were able to attract the creative class by doing so. And I think sort of on the back of those learnings and findings, more and more startups are now thinking about brands and how to integrate them into their product earlier and earlier, and through that, both attract customers, but also build defensive moats. So also prevent your customers from changing to other potential competitors, which obviously are also growing in numbers throughout the years as we're getting, you know, sort of big in technology.
That's really, really fascinating. And if you think about some of the key implications, let's say, for the startup, when deciding upon doing or not doing a brand, what are some of the key implications that you would highlight?
Well, there's a few of them. I don't think really that having or not having a brand anymore is a choice. It's just a question of, you know, whether you want to be aligned both initially internally and then also against your sort of ecosystem in terms of what you want this brand to represent. But it's almost impossible not to represent anything anymore. So, but the typical implications still are the following thing, which is that if if you're a startup that's a deep tech startup and you're focused purely on developing new capacity through technology, then brand might be something that you put on a back burner. But if you're a startup where your sort of customer growth is at the forefront of your kind of objectives, even from the get-go, then obviously that story changes and you need to start doing it immediately.
This sounds very... obviously time-consuming, and I wonder, Maya, maybe you can tell me a little bit more in your experience. How much time and devotion does creating and operating a brand require?
Alrighty, so a couple of very funny things right now. It's interesting that you mentioned Google because I was working for them 7 years ago, but I was also working with a German-based company called Rocket Internet, and their approaches couldn't be more different, right? Whereas Google was kind of umbrella branding stuff before they became Alphabet and whatnot, they had like the crude rebranding product. Rocket Internet was always being like a little bit more submersive, meaning that they have spin-off like brands that were not associated with their core brand umbrella, so Rocket Internet, and they gave it some lifespan before they decided whether this is something that they want to represent or not. And that's exactly how I felt like at the beginning, that branding doesn't necessarily matter and that I can go on Fiverr or on 99designs and I can just hire somebody to do a logo and to do a basic visual identity for me. But little did I know, because that always led us in trouble when it comes to after a business is already 1 or 2 years in, it's really important to consider architecture. And I was lucky enough to work with Sara from Yaka's team to just like help me as a marketeer to understand what are the elements of the brand per se. I'm not saying that you guys at Imperial College are doing a bad job in this, but in a perspective of a like average business person, branding equals logo and maybe some fonts that you are using, right? So you probably want to do this when you are building a website or your visual communications or something like that. And I was gagged, like I was literally astonished by the difference of price ranges, right? So you could have something for a couple of $100, or on the other hand, you could have like those tremendous projects by probably artists that costs like 5 figures. per project. So yeah, that was very confusing for me when I began this journey in terms of branding, but I found some certainty in two aspects of this story. First one is, and that totally calmed me down, is that in the first years, the brand, personal brand of a founder and brand of a startup are somehow connected, right? So you can build brand assets and brand equity by uniting those two. However, when you are evolving and when you are trying to approach different audiences, you should be thinking about how to spin off brands, what the architecture is, and how to make your ecosystem scalable. And that was like one of the wow moments in my life. And I was very lucky for the new project that I just went through. So the academy that I will be launching very soon. Sara from Yaka's teams at D-Labs guide me through this incredible process that helped me tremendously in order to lie down all the elements that are important when you are developing branding strategy. If I didn't know that, I would probably go on 99designs and find a logo that looks chic to me. But that's totally not the right approach. It would be a basic mistake.
That's really interesting. So yeah, I like this idea there of the personal brand and the corporate or product brand at the very beginning being so connected. And I do wonder whether the implication of what you just said is that something that becomes an asset at the very start. So, you know, having, you know, your Steve Jobs or your Elon Musk's on board, et cetera, it's all a great benefit to the brand, potentially becomes a liability later on. Is that the implication of that? Does it become a liability?
I don't know if it necessarily becomes a liability because Elon, for all I know, is doing quite well. He shaked the Bitcoin price recently, so no complaints there. But it's different when you are talking to different audiences. For example, I have a startup which is like very basic in terms of their technology, right? So they basically invented like a band that helps you train your butt into the pitch forum, right? And whenever they are doing like their main stuff, so how to make the booty forming training, meaning they are using their female founder. But when they wanted to launch like dieting programs and stuff that is like more for muscles or stuff like that, they needed another face because their founder's face was no longer associated with the product offering that they were developing for entirely new audience. And that's like the basic thing that I want to say here. So the fit between what founders brand represent for and what is the product offering of that segment. If there's a fit, it's a go. If there isn't a fit, you should probably find another face or another symbol to get this marketed.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you.
Now, talking about faces and fit and so forth, this is really fascinating. But do you think that's equally important in B2C and B2B, or are there any kind of differences?
Jaka, would you mind taking that?
Yeah,
because
sure.
You have been so hardly involved into D-Labs development.
There is still a difference, but it's diminishing. And particularly, I think there's been a huge paradigm shift in the way B2B companies are thinking of moving into the market, particularly if you're a product-led company, right? So if you are, if you have a software product, even though it's a B2B, let's think about the contrast, for example, between how, I don't know, Salesforce came into the market, whatever, 15 years ago, and how, for example, we see Slack coming into the market now. You know, it's a bit of, I think we're sixth or seventh year in, and Salesforce was massively a sales-led sort of market entry strategy, right? So they were trying to do big contracts with big corporates, all based on functionality and pricing. So their strategy adopted sort of the approach that would fit the mold, as opposed to Slack, which basically tried to seduce individual customers and teams in corporations first, and then slowly migrate upwards, you know, throughout the corporation. So even the point being that even if you're a B2B company today, the seduction of your original individual customer is a key stepping stone in this strategy. And in order to do so, the brand becomes equally important as it's a B2C, right? Slack does not represent just a cheaper way to talk in the company. It represents, you know, freedom and expression and connectivity and working remotely and all the attributes and values that they're trying to instill sort of through this process. And the reason why they felt it was so important is because they had the strategy as I was sort of describing before.
Yeah, I love this flow. And if I could just like build up a little bit about that. So I love the company Basecamp, right? They have a very opinionated founder. And I'm not like, I think Asana is better than Basecamp, but I still have some preference towards Basecamp because I do resonate with founders' mentality that much. And what was happening in the last couple of years, and this can be beautifully explained on the example of influencers, right? So if influencers were something that was exclusively B2C, a couple of years ago, maybe even last year, we are including them in B2B marketing strategies right now. Like for each business unit, we could identify influencer or something like that. So don't want to be too academic, but I think it's people to people, right? How we resonate, with whom we associate, with whom do we share this value set. And this is leaning towards one unity in my mind as I'm seeing the market right now.
Thank you. I think one of the common problems, whether we're talking about, you know, startup branding or B2C or B2B, or whether we're talking about established brands, and something that often comes up with our students is a discussion around how do you know if it's working? How do you know if the things we're talking about are actually leading to some results? So, in your world, how do you know when a brand is performing well? What are the metrics of brand performance?
Sure. Well, let me start first, Maya, and then maybe you can build up from me. But so here's where I think just the changes in the approaches we're having as we're launching a brand from a startup perspective, as opposed to how we've done it, you know, let's say 10 or 15 years ago, sort of comes into play. And let me just shed a bit of light on this one, right? You know, today, when we're launching a potentially new business with this massive amount of uncertainty that sort of surrounds any new value propositions, we would now probably even try to start to launch brand first before we have the product. And the way we would try to ascribe the brand would not be through this sort of massive branding, emotional, whatever, you know, campaign that we still sort of envisage, but it would be through sort of a very lean process where we would literally try to align around a couple of key attributes that we try to define around the brand. What is our brand promise? What is the change that we're trying to introduce into customers' lives? What are the key attributes? How are we seeing the context around the customers? How are we perceiving their pain point? And can we translate that into something which resonates with them? So we would formulate these kind of key messages, maybe equip them with some basic visual language. And then we would start off by this super simplistic sort of like brand launch mix or marketing mix that we would sort of go into the market with, right? Typically that would require, you know, a massive sort of approach towards social media. If you're more of a B2B, that means LinkedIn. If you're more of a consumer, that might mean Facebook. If you're an e-commerce, that might mean Instagram. But we would assume that if our brand is to resonate in the future, if our promise is potent enough, we're going to be able to measure that through the engagement on these sort of social media, just by launching sort of few key notions of the fact we exist. This is what we stand for. This is what we want to change. And we would see whether people resonate. So, you know, literally checking the engagement, the comments, the vibrancy of the discussions that happens, you know, once we start to publish or post these original sort of key messages. So I think that still to this very day, the engagement is kind of key. And then there's a variety of tools that we would sort of try to envelope sort of the social media engagement with, such as, you know, trying to get the messaging just done right by potentially creating 10 or 15 different landing pages for a similar brand to test out various messages and then direct the traffic from social media to one or some of these to see which ones resonate and reflect better. The idea here is that you don't suppose you're going to be doing everything right from the get-go. You know you're going to get most of the things wrong, but there's enough of a weak signals coming back from social media that you're able to refine it and then slowly build upon it. And this is where kind of growth and validation and really play hand in hand as we're thinking about these things, right? And I'm kind of curious, actually, Maya, to hear also, you know, from your side, how did you guys, in your sort of experience, what were kind of the key signs of early growth, right? How did you guys, like in your startups, know that you're growing or that you'll be able to grow?
Yeah, what a nice curve roll you just passed me, Aka. I will answer it to it immediately after do my book infomercial. So the stuff that you were just saying about is brilliant because, like, first you need some fundamentals, right? And I like to call it positioning. So there was this book, Positioning, written in 84, and it's still very relevant today. And that's like the Bible of positioning. The second book that is more recent, so it's like 2 years old, it's obviously awesome. And it provides such a nice framework for us as founders to start grounding our mind of how do we even construct the brand in the first place. And with your help, so you have this minimal viable brand framework that I did for my latest project as well, I was able to put these elements down perfectly and create a brief for a designer that did this MVP of a brand. So that was an important part of the process right there. When it comes to like channels, I think you nailed it with social media channels, because whatever community I created so far, whether it was Telegram, Discord, Facebook group, you name them, LinkedIn thingies, like it matters. Two things matters here, like the number of followers is passé, but I like to observe the reach. And if you dive into Google Analytics more in details, I like to see what's going on with organic and direct search, as well as branded ads when it comes to Google Ads, right? So for example, if you invest into a PR placement for your company, you will get like thousands of people bumping on your website on the same day. And not all the traffic will come from referral. There will be like an organic and direct spike as well. Because remember, nobody ever discovers your offering by going to your website. They have to learn about it through channels. And social media is totally powerful. However, here, what is really interesting to observe is that you need to create this, your target audience and channel fit. I just had like this amazing experience in crypto when we were dealing with three or four very differentiated groups. So there was like traders, you know, the greedy animals, the recreational drug users and traders. So that was like a very fierce bunch of folks, and they were communicating on Telegram, which was very specific social media for them. Then we were like selling this technology through B2B channels. So for Oracles and BSIs of the world, which is B2B, it's very boring. It's LinkedIn and maybe a newsletter. And on the first side, we had a developer community that hates all the other social media and is GitHub first. That's why we needed to create this ecosystem of social media that is specifically tailored to the communication flow as well as the channel that is native for a target group. And this is really how you nailed it. You just observe the growth of the channels that are appropriated and tailored to your target audiences. And you need to do one hell of a lot of research to understand that. And that's the last point that I would like to touch down here. Do the research. Your clients know what media channels do they use, where do they like to hang out, where do they get the majority of information that they are inspired from. Definitely don't forget to do influencers and user-generated content. These are the things to be doing for the last 2 years. So that would be pretty much it. But how I would measure it in established brands is literally the organic traffic and, very importantly, the number of recommendations that are being given to the product offering. Because not only do we want brand awareness, we want this to spread, right? We want to create brand ambassadors.
And I must say, it's so refreshing to hear a practitioner bring in books from the 1980s and say, this is still relevant, guys, because it is. But, you know, we inundated sometimes with industry people saying, oh, throw away the book, you know, what, you know, position, it's all dead, it's all old news. It's still very much relevant, isn't it? Maybe the tools in which that we used to do the job are changing slightly. Maybe things are traveling faster. Maybe things are amplified a lot more quickly. But, you know, the fundamental critical concepts and frameworks of marketing are still very much relevant. So thank you so much for reminding us of that.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, all of these insights are real nuggets of gold. It seems that for a brand, on the one hand, you want to have someone, you know, really caring for the brand, loving the brand, sort of the poet, if you wish. But then also, you know, you need number crunchers or people at least comfortable with numbers. So this is challenging. How do you go about selecting the right people for this job or about hiring the right person for this?
Well, I think the key thing that you want to consider, especially being a founder, is that typically founders hire marketers too late. It's sort of one of the counterintuitive things, and I think it has to do with the fact that that startup as an ecosystem, as a community, you know, came primarily from engineering background. So marketing was always sort of, or marketing hires were considered only when it's absolutely really crucially necessary, you know, to start to sort of bring them on board. I think that this is changing right now, and as we're understanding the tool set that we have at our disposal, really, to push forward all these initiatives, I think that also Maya has so vividly sort of opened up to us. We're now seeing sort of this marketing recruitment process obviously starting to happen earlier and earlier. And then I guess the way you would go about hiring really depends on what your sort of market entry strategy is going to be like. If you're first and foremost a consumer-led companies, where, for example, paid channels need to become very early on part of your strategy, understanding the unit economics behind how your channels are converting your potential paid customer, understanding how they would really bring or raise the value throughout the whole funnel. So not just on the acquisition side, but also on the retention and the revenue and the referral side. You know, you need to understand that if you miss the window to get your data structures done right, then whatever you're going to be pouring into it is going to be like a leaky bucket, right? Very, you know, it's going to, yeah, just going to sort of spill over the sides, and you might be wasting a lot of your money into non-optimized sort of channel and customer acquisition. Whereas if you are, you know, more of a sort of validation based, so if you're trying to hit more on sort of on the feature side, on the functionality side, then, you know, your original marketing is really going to be chiseling out the insides and the needs of your sort of first customers. So the difference between hiring one and the second is really the difference in the way you want to go into the market entry. But what we would definitely select is there is a there's probably like a range of skill sets that you're looking for in an early stage marketer that you need to combine somehow, and then maybe look for one strong point out of the following ones. So what you would try to get to definitely is sort of the social media engagement skills. So ability to do social media campaigns, ability to do email campaigns, and connected with both of them, ability to do copywriting and clear out the messaging and positioning, ability to do research. So to decide what the best methodology is, whether you want to do qualitative, quantitative, from customer interviews to industry interviews, you know, to surveys and finding the right sources to give you the lay of the land and the trends. Then the next one that you would want to get into, and I think this is becoming more and more important, is the user experience and design skills, really, because figuring out, you know, or knowing how to utilize certain channels also means to understand what the user flow is going to be looking like through these channels. And if you don't have design skills for that, you're missing out on optimizing sort of these channels through the code. And then the last one probably would also be the data skills. So how do you set up your data structures? How do you set up your funnel? How do you understand conversions? Can you calculate your unit economics? Can you know how to manage the variety of these channels and know which ones to drop and which ones to invest more into? You know, that becomes in the end kind of the crucial side to cleaning out your sort of your marketing channel approach.
That's wonderful advice. Thank you, Jaka. I think one of the other things that has popped up a number of times now in our chat already, we haven't really touched on that much, is the founders, right? And these, whether they're heroes or villains, I have a question for you guys. And I'm going to ask this out quickly, and you've got to think about your answer very quickly. Your worst and best founder that you've ever worked with. No names, just an anecdote. What was your best experience and your worst experience working with a founder?
Wow.
All right, I'm hyperventilating here because I worked with a founder that initially hired me as a marketer. At the end, I did HR, accounting, office management, and whatever was not technical. So in addition to me, he also brought up his wife to the company, which was doing only creative. So I was like spilling my guts out as a generalist to serve 5 different functions. That was the nightmare scenario. And in the best case scenario, I really embraced what Jaka was saying before in terms of hiring generalists first, because you do have to first measure the channels before you commit towards hiring the specialists to do that. And for example, last year I had a like hardware that was launching on Amazon, and we had an external consultant to help us figure it out what the approach towards this launch would be. So we didn't go and hire an Amazon specialist on the company immediately. We first validated this channel with an external help in order for us to just like be able to invest more, right? To internalize this capacity, this competence of the company. So that's always the best way to go, to test first and double down on it if it works. Other than that, like when it comes to founders, gosh, I have so much admiration for founders, because just like the amount of like bandwidth that they are producing, just like the broadness of all the business areas that they have to control. It's okay if they don't do marketing. It's okay if they wanna like be a little bit more of a shy end and something like that. It would benefit though to be personally present in their business, but if they want it, it's their choice, it's their money. So anyways, I have tremendous respect towards founders, and this is probably one of the career paths with the steepest learning curve ever.
Great. Thank you. What about you, Jaka?
Yeah, it's super hard, actually, I have to say. You live amongst sort of these anecdotes, but once you're trying to kind of put something out, you hit upon two things, right, that you're seeing to yourself. One is exactly the point that Maya was touching, right, which is the fact that founders are so easy to make fun of, like really, yeah, but in the same way we make fun of celebrities, right, and their sort of quirks. What we fail to recognize, though, is just the tremendous amount of pressure and just being there for them, right, that sort of requires them to completely devote and dedicate themselves to the businesses that they're trying to grow, whether they like it or not, actually, even whether they show it or not. And it's kind of hard to say what is the good or the bad thing, because funny enough, like in my case, I think this would both be the founders of the unicorns that we built. So, and so, you know, both built massively successful companies. But one of the founders, for example, had a quirk, and it was relevant particularly to marketing, that he would need to show the marketers that he can do better. So we literally had situations where his small marketing team, I think there were like three people at the time, had to stand like at the back of him, behind him, as he was showing them how to create customer emails. And I'm not saying customer acquisition emails, but like, you know, hey, you've created your account type of an email, because this is the way this is done, guys, right? And no other way. And how can you be so stupid not to understand that? So one was this sort of hyperactive, micromanaging, obsessed type of a person, which, you know, most of his marketing team would change every year, by the way, right? So continuous churn throughout. And I'm not sure whether that speaks good for him or bad for their HR, but regardless, it was kind of a constant flow. So, you know, so one was that, and yet, you know, they built a billion-dollar company, I think, much more than that, actually, at this point in time. And I think sort of the other extreme about this thing would be when we literally had situations where there was like a massive event sort of happening. Either it'd be like a new product launch, and we had it two times in a row where literally the founder would go missing. So you would, you know, just out of, and when I say missing, I mean you would call their family and they would say, yeah, you know, it happens
like a
sometimes.
Yeah.
I was saying that, right? You know, there's not a big difference. I think this just happens to people under sort of immense pressure. We literally got a photo from a beach with a cocktail in his hand, like a sort of, not a selfie, because just the hand was sort of pictured, and saying, great job, guys, thanks for saving the company. That was all we get. And then he came back a week later.
Brilliant.
Like, it was nothing, right? Again, billion-dollar company. So, you know.
Absolutely
just
brilliant.
Talking about beaches and cocktails here. If I might just, you know, on the theme that Omar kicked off here of kind of a interesting questions. So what do you do to stay sane? Because you work in a high pressure environment, Jaka and Meyer. So what do you do on a daily basis to just stay motivated, to stay kind of sane?
Maya, do you want to go first?
All right. I do exercise a lot. Sweating is so cleansing, personally, physically, and spiritually. So yeah, this is how I like to start my days, by just like sweat it up a little bit, do a couple of CrossFit exercises or some of the HIIT programs, and that keeps me rolling. Other than that, I really like people. I mean, I'm this typical curious type of a person who's probably an ideal fit for what Jaka described as a first marketeer that you hired. So a generalist, an extremely curious person, and just like the one who likes to have fun with people. And that helps me tremendously. So each day I have like 16 hours of call, but I never get tired of it, because each person is so very interesting. And the last thing that I have to admit to all of you guys, I love my dog. I mean, she's the best. She's literally the best human being in this world. And it relaxes me to see her simplicity. So whenever something is off in my life, I just like watch at her for a little bit. I say, life is pretty simple. We should keep it that way.
It is. I think you're spot on, by the way. I think life that did become a lot simpler, unless you're a CEO of a company, by the way. And unless you're a CEO of a company where there's, you know, most of the people in our space are massive introverts. And that, you know, that has sort of two consequences, which is that a lot of the guys and girls that we employ are alone, are living alone at this point in time. So, you know, so what we saw in the last, you know, and I think it's getting worse over time, is that the company just starts to play a role that vastly overspilled what the company is sort of supposed to do in people's lives. It's sort of, it's literally becoming like a family. There's all these sort of quirks and problems that you have to deal with that we never had. It's funny, because, you know, the more remote we get, the less physically we are sort of in touch, the bigger the need for connection sort of starts to happen. And how to manage these things, I mean, you know, from my standpoint, I'm mostly preoccupied just with that. You sort of take on a bit of a parental persona to a degree, you know, and I think this is also what keeps me grounded on the other side, apart from, you know, the exercise here and there.
Thank you very much. Look, it's been great having you guys. I've got one last question for you to bring this episode to a close. And I guess we have a lot of postgraduate students now in marketing at Imperial College undergoing some of them a one-year program, some of them a two-year program. What's your number one advice to them as they will go on and work in, you know, in a post-COVID-19 world, hopefully? And what would be your number one suggestion to them for their careers?
Cool. So I have a Udemy class with 50K students, and I'm dealing with such questions on a daily basis. My always perfect advice is that you should invent your job, right? So as a young person, you could be an advisor on TikTok. You could be like a experience maker in the VR. Like, you should create your very own blue ocean and just be the rock star of it. Of course, times are hard, but people need like so much new ideas how to elevate on their businesses, right? So I'm always saying like, choose your pocket of success. Do a mini project. Show if you like, of course, perform good, but also if you feel good about this. Have your pilot and just like experiment your way throughout career. Of course, it's sexy to like be approached by big brands or something like that. But the best things in life come very unexpected, by discovery, by just like the passion and enthusiasm. And people who are like new to the workforce and who hasn't been like very much infected with the enterprise mindset, I think that within this new economy where the barriers are like lower than ever, you have such a tremendous opportunity to be entrepreneurs and just like invent the business that you would dream to work in.
And get yourself a dog, right?
Yeah, that happens. That happens. Or a cat if you're a cat person.
Thank you so much. Jaka, what about yourself?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I think, you know, we all have to learn quite a lot from millennials in terms of the way they see their work. Because, you know, when we were sort of entering the workforce, it was like, is it paid? Is it going to be all right? Yeah, sure. Well, we're in, you know, it was a lot more functional, I think. And it's quite inspiring, actually, now when we're getting applications into D-Labs to see just the depth and the range of questions that we're getting about, you know, where this company is supposed to be going and what's the purpose and why I'm into this and why everybody's into this, right? So you see that there's this sort of genuine curiosity around the ecosystem and the purpose. And I think this is something that this generation is sort of, you know, and the Generation Z has learned really, really well. I think a lot better than we ever had. I think the thing that they're missing, though, at times with their questions is, are they going to come in a workspace where the way they set up the processes and objectives are going to be done in a way where they can get acknowledged for their work? What we're seeing, and I think this is the key trap that a lot of people fall into when they go into a startup environment, is that because there's no clear sense of what you need to achieve, there's also no clear sense of whether you're getting better at it. So if you think, you know, that it's all about the purpose, mastery, autonomy, you know, sort of the knowledge economy motivators, you know, it shouldn't be startups can give you a lot of autonomy, but they should also give you a lot of mastery. So figuring out whether it's an environment which can sort of really build up your skill set and your knowledge in your particular space is really crucial. So get ready to ask some tough questions around that as well. And I think that sort of opens up a lot sort of more colorful insight into your potential employer.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. Thank you so much, Jaka. It was a great pleasure to have you. You are inspiring. You're great fun, too, I have to say. And so time was flying. Thank everyone for joining in. I hope you're staying healthy. You're enjoying yourself. As Maya was saying, get a dog. And we're all going to see you hopefully soon.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. It's been fun.
Bye.
Good luck. Ciao.
Bye-bye.